Well, Antonio Gramsci is one of the towering figures in the Marxist tradition, and I think, without doubt, the outstanding leader, both intellectually and politically, in the history of Italian communism. He rose to prominence in Italy's great revolutionary years, during and after World War I. Gramsci and the paper he edited were very much the champions of the insurgent workers of Turin, and in particular of the factory council movement that was at the heart of their rebellion. He played an important role in the foundation of the Italian Communist Party, the PCI, and was its leader by 1924. In 1926, he was jailed by Mussolini's fascists, but in prison, Gramsci continued his work, writing some of the most insightful Marxist analysis of the problems of revolution in the West, alongside a vast array of other things. But a talk about Gramsci can't just be a straight biography, because his is a contested legacy. Gramsci's been claimed by all kinds of somewhat unsavoury people, from the Stalinists to the Euro-communist reformists in the 1970s to the so-called post-Marxist academics in a range of disciplines. And I think it's instructive that almost all of these currents draw primarily, in trying to associate themselves with Gramsci, draw primarily on his prison writings rather than the rich body of intellectual and political activity he engaged in before he was jailed. This began with the by then Stalinized Italian Communist Party itself, when in between 1947 and 1951 they printed quite a large range of selections from Gramsci's prison writings. And it was particularly ironic that they did this, given that earlier on, during the third period in the early 1930s, when Gramsci's defence of the United Front strategy put him very much at odds with the ultra-left line coming out of Moscow, that in this period the PCI not only refused to publish Gramsci's work, but for 2.5 years basically completely erased him from any reference to him in its publications. When Togliatti, one of the main leaders of the party, published an article in 1931 in the party press, sort of reflecting on the history and the experience of the PCI, it contained not a single reference to Gramsci, the party's most significant figure. And even when they did finally publish the prison notebooks and his prison letters, they still contained quite a lot that was able to embarrass the Stalinist Communist Party, in spite of the fact that they heavily censored it and in some cases outright doctored what he'd written. But still, the publication of the prison writings served an important role after World War II for the PCI. As Emmanuel Saccarelli write in his recent book Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism, he said, from the period of the Popular Front onwards, the PCI began to present Gramsci as an intellectual who stood in important respects above the political fray, as a national treasure, a pioneer in various academic disciplines, even as the embodiment of classical virtue. Now, in this period, the PCI covered up the elements in Gramsci critical of Stalinism. But by the 1970s, the Italian party had broken with the USSR and with the history of Stalin, at least in name, and was embracing the openly reformist ideology of what was called Eurocommunism. And now, at this point, Gramsci's criticisms of Stalinism were much more brought to light. But at the same time, his ideas then endured yet another distortion. His expositions of the idea of hegemony and the associated strategy of the war of position, which I'll come back and explain about those later on, these were used as a justification for abandoning the needs for revolution and the overthrow of the state by force, a view which was totally at odds with the positions held by Gramsci during his whole political life. The other area for the distortion of Gramsci's ideas is academia. For them, Gramsci is, as one writer put it, the admirably sophisticated Western Marxist, innocent of the reductionisms of some unspecified vulgar orthodoxy, the able theorist of the superstructure, the theoretical ancestor of a post-Marxist turn. Now, the unspecified vulgarism being referred to here is, of course, practical politics, and in particular, the practical politics of Lenin and the Bolsheviks. And really, it's in academia more than anywhere else that Gramsci's work is reduced to simply his prison writings. And any attempt to connect what he wrote in prison with his revolutionary political activity is rejected. So, for example, Wolfgang Haig wrote, simply to put together Gramsci's somewhat utopian vision from the early 20s with his incomparably more experienced, far-reaching, and at the same time cautious reflections from prison would yield an incoherent concoction. Now, in my opinion, Gramsci's prison writings are quite extraordinary and, you know, brilliant in many parts, but they are necessarily the most open to interpretation of all of his writings due to the deliberate ambiguities employed by him in order to get past the fascist censors. And I think this is a lot of the reason for their appeal. But it's not simply the ambiguity of the prison writings that appeals to academics. I think it's also the fact that in these writings, Gramsci appears most like one of them, an intellectual cut off from the concrete world, its people, and its struggles. So what I want to show in this talk is that Gramsci was not just an intellectual, but a revolutionary activist and leader whose core ideas were concerned with and organically connected to the problems facing the workers' movement. And secondly, that Gramsci wasn't the sophisticated, the reformist, or the undogmatic alternative to Leninism, but that he saw himself as closely interconnected with Bolshevism and that his ideas are firmly situated in the framework of the Communist International in the period it was led by Lenin and Trotsky. Okay, so to look at a bit of Gramsci's life. He's born in 1891. He grew up on the poor feudal island of Sardinia, one of the most backward parts of Italy. From a very young age, he developed what he called an instinct of rebellion against the rich. His early politics were those of southern Italian and Sardinian patriotism, which reflected the oppression of the south by the north in Italy. In later life, he recalled the sentiments of his youth. Into the sea with all the continentals. How many times I repeated those words, he said. Now, as a young man, Gramsci wasn't unaware of the socialist movement. From the age of 14, he received a subscription to the Socialist Party daily, Avanti, and he read, you know, plenty of other socialist literature. But it was really when Gramsci left Sardinia in 1911 to study in the northern city of Turin that his life was transformed. The University of Turin was really a breeding ground for future communist leaders. Togliatti, Terracini and Tusca all studied there at the same time as Gramsci. It wasn't the university, though, in Turin that was what made it such a centre. It was the factories that made it really, you know, the heart of revolutionary militancy in the whole, not just of Italy, but I think of Europe. Gramsci described Turin as the proletarian city par excellence, the Petrograd of Italy. And before Gramsci arrived in Turin, there'd been general strikes in 1902, 1904, 1907, and 1909. And shortly after he arrived in the city, he was witness to two huge metal workers' strikes. And I think it was 1911, 1912, both of which lasted for months. And it was in this period that Gramsci was won to socialism. He joined the Socialist Youth Federation in 1913, and a few months later, the Italian Socialist Party, the PSI. The first few years of his life as an active socialist were dominated by some of really one of the most momentous events in the history, not just of the socialist movement, but in modern history generally. And these events, I think, had a decisive impact on his political development. Of course, first of all, there was World War I and the collapse of the Second International, you know, that backed their own governments in the war. There was the frantic attempt by the anti-war left internationally to try and regroup and build a revolutionary alternative to the betrayals of parties like the German Social Democrats. There was the Russian Revolution of 1917 and saw the Bolsheviks come to power. And then there was the wave of revolutions across Europe that ended the war. And you know, Italy and Turin itself were not at all immune from these great upheavals, quite the reverse. The February Revolution in Russia was met with more enthusiasm in Turin than any other European city. In the middle of 1917, a delegation actually came from the Petrograd Soviet in Russia to address a huge meeting of 25,000 workers in Turin. Now, this was just after the July days in Russia, which had ended in a crackdown on the revolution and the outlawing of the Bolsheviks, whose main leaders, like Lenin, had to go into hiding. And so the Soviet delegates at this point were Mensheviks. They were the majority in the Soviets. So it was much to their surprise and, I suspect, disappointment that they were greeted when they rose up to address the workers by thousands of Chernese metal workers and others chanting "Viva Lenin" as they took to the stage. Now, just later this year, in August of 1917, a monumental workers' revolt broke out in Turin. To give a sense of the tone of this revolt, one account describes workers marching out on strike, proclaiming, "We can't work, we want bread." When they were assured that bread was coming and the bosses were prepared to negotiate and accede to most of their economic demands, they went, "Okay," and turned around and said, "To hell with the bread. We want peace, down with the profiteers, down with the war," and continue to march out of the factory. So, this huge, not just an economic revolt, but a political insurgent revolt. And, before it was finally put down, one estimate says that there were 400 workers had to be killed and 2,000 wounded. So, a big struggle. So that's, the context in which Gramsci was active for the first few years. And, in that time, he played an increasingly prominent role in the socialist movement in Turin. By the beginning of 1916, he was working full-time as a socialist journalist, and the August 1917 revolt that I just referred to brought him to the head of the Turin section. He was made solely responsible for the Turin Party's weekly paper and given a leading role in the political organisation of the party as a member of the Provisional Executive Committee. But to explain how Gramsci fitted into the Italian Party, I just want to look briefly at its sort of political landscape. There were three different factions in the PSI. The right wing, or the reformists, were led by Tirati. Now, they were a minority in the party, a reasonably small minority, actually, but they were concentrated amongst the parliamentarians and other sort of elected officials in town councils and so on, and in the trade union. So they had an influence greater than their number. The majority, though, of the party were the maximalists, who were led by Cerati from Milan. And they controlled the party apparatus, the official leadership of the party and so on, and the party press. The maximalists, as their name suggests, were characterised by an extremely militant, ultra-revolutionary rhetoric. But on the other hand, this was combined with passivity and an accommodation to the reformist wing of the party in practice. The other national group was known as the abstentionists, and they were led by the firebrand revolutionary from Naples, Bordiga. And the abstentionists were, to put it mildly, savage in their criticism of the reformists and also of the maximalists who accommodated to them. And they championed, most famously, the boycott of Parliament. The maximalist majority in the Italian party gave it a quite different dynamic to its social democratic cousins in countries like Germany, where the Socialist Party had backed the war. Counter to this, the Italian socialists were key participants in the 1915 Zimmerwald Conference of the International Anti-War Left, which was held in the Swiss Alps, which in many ways was the precursor to the Third International. And it was, in fact, a motion put by the Italian party that was adopted as the Zimmerwald Manifesto. Cerati, the editor of Avanti, actually risked jail by publishing the manifesto, in spite of being outlawed by the Italian censors. The way he did it was required by law at the time. They had to submit the paper. They had a four-page daily paper. They submitted it to the censors in Milan, who looked at it, thought it was innocuous, and approved it, and so on. And then, as soon as they got it back from the censors, Cerati replaced what had been the innocuous second page with the manifesto of the Zimmerwald Conference, handed to the printers, and printed it throughout Italy and even internationally in France and so on. The only place they didn't print it was in Milan, where the censors were, which possibly was a prudent course of action. The young socialists who were aligned to the maximalists at this time began wearing a badge as they travelled around town that gave a thinly veiled indication of their loyalty. It proclaimed their membership of the Zimmerwald Alpine Federation. So, subtle, but really this subtlety was something of an exception in the Italian party. Really, the norm was, extremely intransigent revolutionary rhetoric. The left faction, for example, in Turin was actually named the Intransigents. But then perhaps concerned that they weren't making their approach to life sufficiently clear, they renamed themselves the Rigid Intransigents. So as to remove any doubt. So that was the tone of the times, and the Russian Revolution further radicalised the Italian party. The maximalist leader, Sarardi, who was wholehearted enthusiast for Lenin and for the Russian Revolution, moved from support for a constituent assembly to demand a dictatorship of the proletariat, which was confirmed as the party line at a meeting of the directorate in December of 1918. The PSI voted by 10 to 3 on its leadership to join the Comintern in March of 1919, only weeks after it was established, and the Italians were the only mass party, other than obviously the Bolsheviks, to do so. Now, through all this, Gramsci wasn't aligned to any of the factions of the PSI, and he had criticisms of all of them. Obviously, he was highly critical of the reformists and, shared the scathing attitude of Bordiga on them. But he was also critical of the abstentionists for their, their advocacy of a boycott, that Gramsci thought that participation in elections was necessary as a form of revolutionary education for the masses. But, as I say, he supported the abstentionists in their hostility to the reformists and their strong support for the Communist International. He also differed from the maximalists on a number of points. He argued against their crude workerist rhetoric and stressed the national character of the proletarian revolution, that it would improve the lives of all of the underprivileged classes in Italy, including the petty bourgeoisie. He also resented the lack of emphasis on the peasant question in the party press and from the maximalists. And this was really a legacy of Gramsci's experience growing up in the South. And as well, and I think most importantly, he argued that there were significant dangers in inflammatory ultra-left statements when they were combined with demanding nothing from the workers but sort of passive expectation that things would work out. I think it's worth, this summary of the sort of dynamic of the Italian party when you then go forward to the way Gramsci's presented by, the Euro-communists in the 1970s. Actually, I was just reading last night that one of Blair's advisors in the mid-90s actually said that what Blair was doing in Britain was sort of implementing the Gramscian project. Well, actually, if you look at the real situation, not only was Gramsci a million miles to the left of any of these people, but actually pretty much everyone in the Italian party, all the people that Gramsci criticised from the left, were also a million miles, not just to the left of Blair, but to the left of the Euro-communists and reformists in the 70s that champion Gramsci. So it really makes a mockery of their claim to have anything to do with his politics. So Gramsci's criticisms of the other groups in the PSI led him and his supporters to establish a new paper, Ordine Nuovo, which is the New Order, which published its first issue in May of 1919. And at the centre of Gramsci's project here was the promotion in Italy of an equivalent to the Soviets that had played such an instrumental role in the Russian Revolution. The paper, though, didn't immediately take up this cause. It wasn't until June 21 of 1919 that Gramsci had wrested control from Tasca of the paper, who he preferred it to be a sort of theoretical journal rather than what Gramsci saw it as being a means to organise workers around concrete questions, as well as convince them of the need to fight for socialism in the here and now. And I've got quotes from this. This is the sort of main article where they put out their manifesto of the of what the factory council should be like. And Gramsci posed the question: how can the immense social forces that the war has unleashed be harnessed? How can they be disciplined and given a political form that has the potential to develop smoothly into the skeleton of the socialist state in which the dictatorship of the proletariat will be embodied? And he answered, the proletariat and semi-proletarian classes must be transformed into an ordered society which can educate itself, acquire experience, and develop a responsible awareness of the duties which weigh on any class that accedes to the power of the state. So the basic conditions, Gramsci argued, for a new workers' state was that institutions be organs of the whole of the working class. And because of that, the Socialist Party wasn't going to be equipped for this task. Not just because, as Gramsci argued, that for the Socialist Party and the trade unions to absorb the whole of the working class will be the work of years and even decades, but also because he argued because the Socialist Party could not throw open its doors to all elements of the working class without being without diluting itself and undermining its ability to act as the vanguard or the leading element in the struggle. So instead, Gramsci proposed the workshop commissions, which existed already in the factories, are organs of workers' democracy which must be freed from the constraints imposed on them by the bosses and infused with a new life and energy. At the moment, these commissions have the task of curbing the power the capitalist exerts within the factory, and they perform an arbitrational and disciplinary function. In the future, developed and improved, they should be the organs of proletarian power, replacing the capitalist in all his useful managerial and administrative functions. Workers could proceed, Gramsci said, right now, to elect vast assemblies of delegates chosen amongst the best and most politically aware comrades under the slogan, all the power in the workshop to the workshop committees, together with the other complementary slogan, all state power to the workers' and peasants' councils. So propose to transform the internal commissions into these new bodies. Now, of course, it'd be nice if socialists could at any time in place sort of write up a series of proposals or suggestions like this to, you know, transform the workers' movement and have it taken up in short order. But unfortunately, it doesn't usually work like this, as countless sort of tragicomic attempts to do so have proven in recent years. But at this particular juncture, in the context of rising revolutionary sentiment and insurgent working class struggle, Gramsci's proposals had an electrifying impact. By August of 1919, the plan had its first significant adherents. The internal commission at Fiat Centro, which is the largest plant in Turin, resigned and called for the election of a council, including a commissar from each industrial division of the plan. By October 26, more than 50,000 Turinese workers in 30 plants were organised into councils, and this figure grew to 115,000 workers organised in councils by the end of the year. So quite extraordinarily rapid progress. By December, both the PSI and the Chamber of Labour in Turin had signed statements approving the council factory movement. In October, a general assembly of the factory councils had been held and adopted a general programme which had largely been drawn up by Gramsci. The councils were democratic. Their delegates had mandates that were revocable by a referendum of workers at any given moment. In one of Gramsci's articles, the task of the commissars in the factories, which was adopted as policy, set out three main aims for the councils. One was the defence of the rights of labour. Two was the preparation for the seizure of power in the factories. And three was the education of the workers. And Gramsci argued that the factory council is the model of the proletarian state. All the problems inherent in the organisation of the proletarian state are inherent in the organisation of the council. So he saw them as central to the project of laying the basis for the transformation to a workers-run society, or a workers' government. But within the PSI, the Socialist Party, Gramsci found almost no support for his view on the councils. Tirati and the reformists considered the idea of councils that included non-unionised workers, which to be some form of anarchism. Tirati, the maximalist, also opposed the inclusion of non-unionised workers and argued that the only possible dictatorship of the proletariat is a conscious dictatorship of the Socialist Party. And Bordiga also counterposed the Soviets, not to the Socialist Party, but to a pure Communist Party, which he said the only representative organ embodying the general revolutionary interests of the proletariat could be a Communist Party of dedicated revolutionaries. So all these critiques, even though they came from slightly different directions, all what they had in common was a top-down approach to the revolutionary process and to workers' struggle. Either, you know, the Socialist Party is as it existed, or a new pure Communist Party would lead the revolution, and it would be conducted, you know, from above on behalf of the workers and peasants, rather than relying on their active organisation and involvement. Okay, so in April of 1920 in Turin, 500,000 workers joined a general strike, which was provoked by the employers, and this dispute rapidly became a battle for the control of the production process through the factory councils. And it was a huge struggle. You know, 50,000 troops were stationed in the city, One account describes how gun batteries were standing ready on the hills, armored cars are roaming the streets in the suburbs reputed to be particularly rebellious. Machine guns are trained on the houses, on all bridges and crossroads, and on the factory gates. It was a huge, violent struggle. And after 11 days, it was defeated, largely because the PSI leadership refused to support the Turin workers and spread the action beyond the city. And Gramsci reacted bitterly to this betrayal. His denunciation was read out at the Milan conference of the party. He called upon the PSI to prepare for revolution, since the contemporary period would mark either success of proletarian revolution or usher in the most terrible of reactions, which turned out to be a fateful prophecy. He claimed the PSI leaders had failed to help the strikers because they did not live immersed in the reality of the class struggle because the party was too bureaucratic. And so he drew from this the conclusion that the existence of a strongly disciplined and cohesive communist party, which through its nuclei in the factory, unions and cooperatives, coordinates and takes central control in its executive committee of all revolutionary actions of the proletariat, this is the fundamental and indispensable condition for attempting any Soviet experiment. So, moving very rapidly to see the need for a new party, a break with the existing socialists. And Lenin and the leaders of the Comintern read this document written by Gramsci and commented on it at the Second Congress of the Comintern in July of 1920, so a few months later. And Lenin said, "The Second Congress of the Third International regards the criticisms of the party and the practical proposals put before the National Congress by the Turinese section of the party in Ordine Nuovo as substantially correct. They correspond fully to the fundamental principles of the Third International." Now, Gramsci wasn't, and actually none of the representatives of his supporters were actually at this Comintern conference. And so I think given that, and given the fact that all the Italian delegates who were there furiously denounced Gramsci and said he was a syndicalist and an anti-party and so on, it's quite remarkable that Lenin was prepared to take such a strong position on the basis of having read one of Gramsci's documents. Alistair Davidson, a historian of Gramsci, concluded from this that what it amounts to is an endorsement by Lenin of Gramsci's views on the PSI before he really knew what they meant and before Gramsci had read any of Lenin's views on the party. And I think that quote points to something quite important about the relationship between Lenin and Gramsci in the period immediately after the revolution, the Russian Revolution, and that is that they knew very little about each other at all. And yet, what Gramsci did know of Lenin, what he could glean from the various, writings in the international press and so on, impressed him greatly. Part of his admiration, and the one that's generally commented on, was based on the idea of the Soviet, in Russia, a concrete example, as Gramsci saw it, of how workers could reorganize society and something to be emulated. But Gramsci also saw in Lenin, and I think he was absolutely right in this, a radical break with the sterile determinism that had destroyed the Second International and contaminated Marxist theory and philosophy. And this was reflected in the first article that Gramsci had written in response to the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution, which was titled The Revolution Against Capital, by which he meant Marxist capital, not capitalism. Now, this article was predictably attacked as being, idealistic and so on, and, there are elements of that in it. But I think its great strength, even this is the first thing he wrote about the Russian Revolution, its great strength was the vigour with which it demolished the mechanical dogmatism of official Marxism. Where are we? Gramsci wrote, "Even if the Bolsheviks renounce certain of Marx's assertions in Capital, that does not mean that they renounce the deeper message, which is its lifeblood. All that it means is that they are not Marxists. They have not used the master's words to compile a rigid doctrine made up of dogmatic and unquestionable claims. They are living out Marxist thought, the real, undying Marxist thought. And this true Marxist thought has always identified as the most important factor in history, not crude economic facts, but rather men themselves and the societies they create as they learn to live with one another and understand one another." So I think that gives a sense, and there's heaps of people should read some of his articles from there, a sense of what he was like. Later in the prison notebooks, Gramsci developed his views on the relationship between what he called different moments or levels in the relations of forces, which I think undermine any claim that he was simply an idealist, but I won't go into that now. But it wasn't just on the question of rejecting fatalism that Gramsci and Lenin's views coincided. Gramsci's writings on the trade union bureaucracy, which in many ways are, I think, an advance on Lenin's, clearly share his underlying arguments. Gramsci's later writings on the relationship between spontaneity and consciousness also, you know, very much bear the hallmarks of Lenin. And as I've noted earlier, Lenin immediately had endorsed Gramsci's position on the relationship between party and class in the Italian Revolution as being, you know, as essentially the same as that advocated by the Comintern. But it is true that Gramsci had underplayed the importance of the party, you know, until the abject failure of the socialists to lead the April uprising. And the occupation of the factories, which I don't have time to talk about, I wish I did, in the second half of 1920 further convinced him and thousands of others on the left of the PSI of the urgent need for a new party. The factory occupations were basically the last great upsurge of the post-war period in Italy and the last chance for workers to push forward their struggle and take power. But again, the opportunity was squandered as the PSI and the union leaders diffused the struggle, which led to not only its defeat and the failure of the occupations to move forward to power, but led to a huge wave of fascist reaction. And, yeah, so Gramsci in this period hadn't, the earlier period, hadn't argued to set up a new Communist Party. I hadn't seen that as the central part of his politics when he was involved in the council movement, particularly in 1919. The person who had organised a national faction aiming to set up a Communist Party free of the reformists was Bordiga. And in the second half of 1920, Gramsci very much fell in behind Bordiga as the momentum developed for a decisive showdown at the party's Livorno conference at the end of that year. Now, I think, sorry, the fact that Bordiga, a sincere, true, but nonetheless dogmatic ultra-left, the fact that he was the leader and the organiser of the move to form a new party caused quite major problems. Aided by a frankly pretty insane ultra-left intervention by the Comintern representatives at the conference, Bordiga led a split that not only broke with the right-wing reformists, but also with the overwhelming bulk of the maximalist centre, without which it was impossible to set up a new mass communist party. So the far left walked out of the conference and secured 59,000 of the votes compared to Sarardi's maximalist got 98,000 and the right wing 15,000. So, you know, a minority, a substantial one, but that really overstates the size of the new Communist Party. That in 1920 there were over 200,000 members of the PSI, but less than 100,000, only less than half of those, you know, continued their membership into either the new Communist Party or to the PSI in 1921, and the Communist Party was considerably smaller than the PSI. Gramsci had played a little role, a public role anyway, at the Livorno Conference, and in the first period of the new party, he loyally backed Bordiga, even when he objected to Bordiga's policies. So when Bordiga denounced the United Anti-Fascist Organisations that had been set up semi-spontaneously in a way to physically resist Mussolini's thugs, Gramsci accepted Bordiga's line of opposition to them. He repeated the idiocy that fascism was just another form of bourgeois reaction, whose time in power would be brief, and that if fascism destroyed parliamentary democracy, this would benefit the left, because it would destroy illusions in parliamentary change. Didn't work like that. Now, the exact reasons that Gramsci went along with Bordiga to the extent he did is impossible to tell, but clearly he'd been badly shaken by the last period of the PSI, and on one level he recognised that Bordiga, you know, in his early intransigence and determination to set up a new Communist Party, that Bordiga in a fundamental sense had been right about that argument. And, you know, how much this led him to defer to Bordiga and go along with things he didn't agree with, and how much it led him to actually accept some of Bordiga's arguments, you know, we don't know. But what we can say is that this period represented Gramsci's most significant breach with the Comintern in the era of Lenin and Trotsky. But I think this should provide cold comfort to those reformists, you know, academics and so on, who want to claim that somehow Gramsci was less rigid or less concerned with building a supposedly elite communist party than Lenin. Because actually in this period of the breach, far from being less belligerently revolutionary than Lenin, the Italians were more so. On the question of the United Front, is working with the reformists to try and defeat the fascists. It was actually Lenin and Trotsky who were arguing that the communists needed to reach out and form a united bloc and to make compromises to find allies and so on. So, you know, you definitely can't draw from that, you know, that disagreement with Lenin that Gramsci was somehow not a party building intransigent revolutionary. In 1922, he was appointed to, fortunately, I think, appointed as the Italian Party's representative on the Comintern executive, and he moved to Moscow. And so there, Gramsci's close connection to both the Comintern leaders and as well as that, his readings about the growing crisis in Italy, the fascists had taken power, the Communist Party was in disarray and under attack and so on, that this finally convinced Gramsci he needed to take a firmer stand against the ultra-left politics of Bordiga. And actually, in April of 1923, it was Bordiga who threw down the gauntlet, writing a major manifesto attacking the United Front, attacking the slogan of the workers' government and the idea of fusion with the PSI, all of which had been policies advocated by the Fourth Congress of the Comintern. And Gramsci took his stand at this point, and a long, drawn-out factional struggle ensued, which wasn't finally to be resolved until 1924, when Gramsci took over as leader of the party. And it was the course of this struggle and the elaboration of the argument in favour of the United Front that Gramsci started to develop some of the ideas that would later absorb a great deal of his thinking. He agreed with the argument put most forcefully by Trotsky that the United Front was necessary because capitalism had stabilised itself in the West and the revolution was not on the immediate agenda. He also agreed with the argument, which was actually advanced by the Comintern, although it's often attributed as just, Gramsci's own unique innovation. The argument that this wasn't the stabilisation of capitalism in the West wasn't simply a cyclical shift, but reflected the fact that the institutions of bourgeois rule had proven much stronger and more resilient in the West than they had been in Tsarist Russia. And actually, this argument had come up in the Comintern even before the United Front policy was adopted at the Third Congress, at the Second Congress. In 1920, the Congress, the supposedly ultra-sectarian 21 conditions, actually there, it was commonly advanced that whereas in Russia the Civil War was taking place after the revolution, in the West the Civil War would take place before the revolution as the stronger and more entrenched bourgeoisie would be much harder to dislodge. So Gramsci now argued that the direct determinism that moved the Russian masses into the streets to revolutionary assaults was complicated in Central and Western Europe by all the political superstructures created by the greater development of capitalism. It rendered mass action slower and more cautious, and therefore demands from the Revolutionary Party a system of strategy and tactics much more complex and long range than those used by the Bolsheviks between March and November 1917. So Gramsci was imprisoned in 1926, and he wasn't to emerge for over a decade from prison, and even then he was only allowed out to die. Because of the watching eye of the fascist censor, Gramsci's prison writings, as I said at the start, were very different in tone to his early work. But I think in prison, he very much developed and built on both the political ideas and the experiences that he'd had as a revolutionary leader early on, and very much developed them in the context of being a loyal part of the Communist International. And, just to take one of his ideas, the one most famous of hegemony, which is frequently asserted to be, Gramsci's great innovation and contribution to, Marxism and to Western thought. Much more the proper focus, I suppose, of, sort of self-satisfied intellectual wankery than, nasty crude polemics by the likes of Lenin and Trotsky. But, this idea of hegemony, though, as Perry Anderson documented extremely exhaustively in his Antinomies of Antonio Gramsci, he documented that the term hegemony was one of the most central political slogans in the Russian social democratic movement from the late 1890s to 1917. And I've only got a chance to use a fraction of the examples that he cites, but he points out that Martov, the Russian revolutionary, wrote in 1901, "The struggle between the critics and the orthodox Marxists is really the first chapter of a struggle for political hegemony between the proletariat and bourgeois democracy." Lenin referred in a letter written to Plekhanov to the famous hegemony of social democracy and called for a political newspaper as the sole effective means of preparing a real hegemony of the Russian working class. After the defeat of the 1905 revolution, Lenin vehemently denounced the Mensheviks, arguing the proletariat is revolutionary only insofar as it is conscious of and gives effect to this idea of the hegemony of the proletariat. Renunciation of the idea of hegemony is the crudest form of reformism in the Russian social democratic movement. From the standpoint of Marxism, the class, as the working class, so long as it renounces the idea of hegemony or fails to appreciate it, is not a class or not yet a class, but a guild or the sum total of various guilds. And it goes on and on like this. So it's true that, you know, Gramsci developed this idea and used it to build an explanation of the strength of Western capitalism, but you know, you have to see that he's operating in a broader framework that was initiated in Russia itself. So what he argued was that the power of the ruling class in the West rests not only on physical control through the military police apparatus, but also on ideological domination, which is exercised through a network of voluntary institutions that pervade everyday life, what he called civil society. That is the political parties, the trade unions, the churches, the mass media, and as well, I think, the institutions of parliamentary democracy that create the illusion of popular control over society. So the repressive state apparatus, Gramsci argued, is only one of many defences of capitalist society. And this civil society in the West, Gramsci argued, had become a very complex structure and one which was resistant to the catastrophic incursions of the immediate economic elements, crises, depressions and so on. And he said that this fact had important strategic consequences for the working class struggle. He argued that in the West, the strength of bourgeois society meant that the first task of the socialist movement was to fight what he called a war of position, to break the working class from the ideological hold of the institutions of bourgeois society. So winning this, what he called the battle for hegemony, was a prerequisite to victory in the war of manoeuvre, the insurrectionary overthrow of the capitalist state. Now, although Gramsci emphasised the element of consent as a means to maintain bourgeois rule, he also maintained that behind consent and intertwined with it and reinforcing it was its twin, force. And because of this, he never resiled from the arguments he put forward in the Lyons thesis demanding the construction of a communist party whose tasks include putting to the proletariat and its allies the problems of the insurrection against the bourgeois state. And I'd suggest that most people who go on rabbit on about hegemony and Gramsci wouldn't like that sentence terribly much at all. So his argument for a war of position was very much a continuation of his argument in favour of the United Front, which he saw as the crucial strategic means through which the hegemony of the bourgeoisie could be broken. And he was quite clear that his ideas about hegemony, about the war of position and the United Front connected to it, were indebted to Lenin. He wrote in the prison notebooks, "The greatest modern theorist of Marxism," which in prison notebooks speak is that's Lenin, which tells you something in and of itself. "The greatest modern theorist of Marxism has, on the terrain of political organisation and struggle and in political terminology, revalued, in opposition to diverse economist tendencies, the doctrine of hegemony as the complement to the theory of the state as coercion." So, you know, very much sees himself as linked to Lenin, linked to the United Front, and his, you know, arguments about the role of civil society, about the war of position and so on, very much in that framework. Okay, so to wind up, I've emphasised in the talk Gramsci's activism as a revolutionary and his connection with the Third International. And I think this is important to do, given the way his ideas have been distorted and he's been attempted to be claimed by all kinds of people whose politics he had nothing to do with at all. But in doing this, I didn't want to give the impression that Gramsci had nothing new to say, or that, you know, if you've read Lenin, there's nothing new to be learnt from Gramsci. Quite the reverse. The fact that Gramsci was not only an intellectual doesn't take away from the fact that he's one of the great theorists and writers in the Marxist tradition. And in this end, I'd really encourage people here to actually go and read Gramsci for yourselves, because you know, academia has really created an aura around Gramsci that, you know, somehow his writing is incredibly obscure and hard to get into and so on, and that really, if you're going to understand him, first you have to go and read 20 or 30 commentaries and explanations and so on. Well, I think don't believe this at all. That the reality is that most of the academic writing on Gramsci is incredibly, you know, denser and more hard to understand and usually totally illogical than anything that Gramsci wrote himself. That, you know, all of his writings are incredibly accessible, and even the prison notebooks you know, once you've worked out that the, you know, the philosophy of praxis is Marxism and that, you know, the modern prince is the Communist Party. Actually, the prison notebooks aren't that hard to understand, at all. And really, it's my firm conviction that the distortions of Gramsci's legacy rely on the hope that people will only read Gramsciology instead of actually reading Gramsci, because it's impossible. If you look through not only his, you know, his political history and his activism in the struggle, but to read, you know, his writings both in the early period during the councils, his struggles during the 1920s, and then as well what he wrote in prison, it's impossible to come away from that without, you know, seeing this urge to revolt, this incredibly passionate and committed revolutionary, really leaping out at you from every page of his work and every aspect of his life. And I'll finish there.